This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. This hour, we are playing for you the award-winning examples of journalism that your public radio station produced right here in 2017. WGCU is a member-supported service of Florida Gulf Coast University. We say that a lot, and what that means is we're here on the FGCU campus and we work with the support of the university. We also work because of the support we get from our listeners. It's because of people like you who are listening right now that we're able to do the kind of award-winning work that you're about to hear. So thank you for trusting us to do this work. It's because of that trust that you have in us that our news team basically moved into the radio station over the course of Hurricane Irma, where we were able to stay on the air throughout the storm for several hours, tracking the storm's movement and speaking with emergency personnel and first responders the whole time. Our reporters were embedded at the Lee and Collier County Emergency Operations Centers, and for that coverage, our team won a regional Edward R. Murrow Award. After the storm, our reporters continued to live at the radio station and went out into the aftermath to gather stories, which brings me to the first award winner. This is Rachel Iacovone reporting on Governor Rick Scott's visit to Everglades City after the storm. This story won a regional Edward R. Murrow Award for Hard News and took first at the Florida Associated Press for General Assignment Reporting.
The small community is known for its airboat rides and fishing spots, and now for taking some of the worst of Hurricane Irma's wrath. Governor Rick Scott stopped by Sunday afternoon to survey the damage.
The water's still really high here. I listened to them talk about how much they got into their homes. That's how much work it's going to be to get the stuff cleaned up. It's going to be a significant issue with housing.
As the governor walked the damp and debris-lined streets of Everglades City, thousands of people in the area were still without power, and many, now, are without a home. One of them is Jordan Mayberry. The 31-year-old mother of two spent her Sunday taking the insides of her new home, piece by piece, to the curb.
We just finished it exactly the way we wanted it. We just put up the fence, we just put in a new pool and the garage and the backsplash and the tiles, every single thing that you can walk in the house and see that's visible to the eye.
Mayberry looks away toward the pieces of her new fence laying across her muddy backyard.
I'm sorry.
She wipes tears from her eyes.
It took us 3 years, paycheck to paycheck, getting everything exactly the way we wanted it. We just put in our plantation shutters that I picked up a season job just to get those.
Mayberry works as a neurological nurse at Naples Community Hospital. Her husband is a firefighter. Both of their jobs required them to work during Hurricane Irma. After the storm, the two came home to discover the 10-foot storm surge had flooded their raised house up to the electrical outlets, destroying almost everything inside.
The first day that I came in to clean everything out, I didn't wear a mask. And just that one day of wearing no mask, it hurt to swallow that night.
Mayberry says she sees and smells mold growing in their home since the water receded. Her neighbors are complaining of similar respiratory issues as they clean up as well, while others are becoming severely ill in Irma's wake. Published reports say Everglades City resident Lee Martini died of respiratory failure and internal bleeding Saturday. David Curry had his leg amputated Friday after it was critically infected by the dirty water. Mayberry says, despite her losses, she is grateful to have her family, both her literal family and the family she's gained since moving to Everglades City from her native Naples 3 years ago.
We lost our homes, but we found humanity. Everglades City is a very close community. It's a small town.
A complete stranger slows and calls to her and her neighbors from his car, offering to do their laundry for free.
See what I'm saying?
Rachel Iacovone, WGCU News, Everglades City.
The second story we'd like to share with you today is one from WGCU's Jessica Mazaros. As residents of Everglades City remained without temporary housing for weeks after the storm, this piece of reporting won in the general assignment long format category at the Florida Associated Press.
So this is our little place here.
Patty Demery is holding her youngest of five children, Augustus, on her hip. From the street, they're looking at what used to be their trailer home. Now, windows are missing, gray mud is spread across the lawn and patio deck, and there's a pile of debris in front of the property that's almost as long as the two-bedroom mobile home itself. But Demery says the worst of the damage is inside.
Would it be okay to take a look?
Sure.
Oh, thanks.
Just be careful, that's muddy, and a lot of the mud is still here because this used to all be grass.
Water's still here,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And like this gray stuff on top, that's the mud that came in.
Oh, really? Into the house?
also? Yeah, it settled everywhere. Okay, you have the door open. We've taken the carpet out so you can't see what was on top of the carpet, but if you go and look that direction, you can see how the water line is, and then all the mold started growing up.
Floodwaters left dark blotches a few feet high on the white walls of what used to be the kitchen. And above the water line is spotted mold. Demarie and her family gutted just about all of the trailer's insides.
How does it feel seeing it like this?
I don't know. I mean, you don't want it to be like this, but we wanted to kind of rebuild and get something bigger. That's what we had been looking into anyways. We were just kind of waiting for the time, and I guess the time is now.
And back the window.
What happened to the window?
And the hurricane broke it, and the glass fell down.
For now, Demarie's family is staying at her mother-in-law's house in Estero, more than an hour away. They make the commute daily for her husband's work, the kids' school, and after-school activities. She'd like to get some temporary housing in Everglades City while they rebuild.
Because it's hard to drive back and forth, and our kids play sports, so they've got practice and they've got games, and so it's been tough.
Demarie and her husband applied for assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And she says she's been told they're going to get help, but she hasn't been given any details yet. Dan Summers is with Collier County Emergency Management. He says it's taken nearly a month to get temporary housing solutions for Everglades City residents because of an unusual combination of things.
Number one was how much impact the hurricane had on the federal system in Houston. The federal resources were heavily drained for that event. Number two, of course, is the almost 60 counties in Florida being impacted by Irma. So there was, again, a very large drain on state and federal assets. And then that's being compounded by the catastrophic conditions in Puerto Rico, where FEMA is also answering the call for service.
Summers says FEMA is planning to eventually use local hotels and rental properties to house the displaced people of Everglades City, as well as bring in mobile homes. Everglades City Interim Mayor Howie Grimm said Wednesday he expects temporary housing relief from FEMA in about a week.
We're not going to be forgotten. I'm not going to let us be forgotten. If I have to scream and holler at every person I get on the phone to get what they need, you know, I love the town, I love the people, you know, and it's all about family, and that's what we all are. I don't care where you came from. When you go through an experience like this, you become family. So we're going to look out for our family, and we're going to make it through it. It's going to be tough for a while, but we'll be fine.
Mayor Grimm says the long-term goal for housing in the Everglades City area of about 1,000 residents is to get every home on stilts to prevent this from ever happening again. Jessica Mazaros, WGCU News, Everglades City.
If you're just joining the show, we're taking a look back at the award-winning stories WGCU put together last year. We've talked about hurricane coverage, which dominated headlines and lives since Irma tore her way up the state. But before the hurricane, the atmosphere of news was active all year. In August, people took to the streets to call for or to protest the removal of Confederate monuments and statues. In this piece by Jessica Mazaros, we go to Manatee County, where a protest and counter-protest got heated. This story took the top prize at the Florida Associated Press longer format hard news category.
Across the street from Twin Dolphin Marina, Black Lives Matter Minnesota leader Shakira Rifos prepares the protesters for what they're marching into. She uses her megaphone to tell them there are people with differing opinions at their destination, the Manatee County Courthouse.
When you get there, people are going to try to antagonize you. They're going to try to ask you questions. They're going to try to call you names. They're going to try to do a lot of things to take you off of your focus. And it's very important that we just pretend like they are literally not there. They're not there.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, the monument has got to go. Hey, hey.
The protesters start their half-mile march carrying signs saying things like "All unite to end racism" and "No KKK, no fascist USA." They want a Confederate statue that stands tall in front of the county courthouse, removed from the public space, and put somewhere like a museum. One of the people leading the march is Manatee County Commissioner Charles Smith of District 2. He says the monument represents treason, slavery, and the overall suppression of black people in America.
The monument is detrimental to our community because of the fact we got to tell the whole history, not part of it. We don't need to teach our children hatred. The white supremacist groups, KKK, the neo-Nazi have hijacked the monument all across America, have turned it into a symbol of racism, and they want us to teach our children that. But we must be better than that. We must understand that we all was created equal. That courthouse is supposed to be for equal justice. It's not for white justice. It's not for black justice. We all are one people.
The marchers arrive at the courthouse gazebo, just a few feet away from the statue, which the county has hidden with boards of plywood to protect it. Manatee County Sheriff's deputies surround the area wearing riot gear, standing motionless while keeping a watchful eye. Behind the gazebo are a few dozen counter-protesters with their own megaphones and signs, and also a large Confederate flag waving in the air. Both groups eventually interact.
You don't like America.
Why you bring us here? Why you?
Then Shakira Rifos, the Black Lives Matter leader, puts a stop to it. The protesters turn their backs to Bob Bolis, who wants the Confederate statue to stay where it is, because he says it's part of American history. Bolis was just pointing both his middle fingers at them while yelling, if they don't like America, go back to Africa.
I'm not a racist anywhere. I have black people work for me. What I was telling them, respect is earned, not demanded. They're here being radical terrorists. That's all this group is.
What is radical about what's happening here?
Everything they're doing is radical. They're turned on American history. They don't have that right.
Well, I spoke with the leader. The leader wants to put it in a museum and not in a public space.
They don't have any more right with Black Lives Matter crap than anybody else does.
Despite other scattered verbal arguments, the event ends with people protesting the Confederate statue, holding hands and singing. Shakira Rifos and other protest leaders gather at a restaurant just after the march.
It was really powerful. It was awesome to see these people from all different walks of life just come together. You know, we marched and then we stood and then we applauded and we listened to one another. We resisted antagonization. We turned our backs to it and turned in, like, with love. Like, there was so much love there. That's the best part.
Jessica Mazaros, WGCU News, downtown Bradenton.
That was the first place award-winning story by Jessica Mazaros, which won for Hard News Longer Format at the Associated Press Awards. Earlier in the year on this program, Gulf Coast Live, we talked about the local impacts of Trump's first immigration ban. We talked with an immigration attorney and with two people from countries included in that travel ban, Iranian-American artist Leila Mezdaghi and Imam Mohammed Al-Darsani from Syria. This program was a finalist in the Associated Press's Public Affairs category. In this excerpt, we hear as Mr. Al-Darsani realized, on the air, that he may not be able to see his brother, who lives in Damascus, for some time. Mohammed Al-Darsani, you've been a public face for the Islamic community in Southwest Florida for a while now, but you're originally from Syria, and I never knew that. And I've met you a few times now.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Syria.
Tell me about...
I came to this country when I was 25 years old.
Well, tell me about the Syria that you left.
You don't want me to cry.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to make you do that. Well, you were 25 years old, and that was, what, like 2 years ago? I'm just joking. Try to make you laugh.
It seems like that. Unfortunately, I was thinking exactly about the same things Layla's been talking about. Due to travel situations also, because of the Syrian governments, when my father died, I couldn't be there when my father died. When the revolution in Syria started, my mother was extremely sick. I was there in 2009, 2010. And in 2011, the revolution started early in March. And in July, my mother passed away, but I tried to go and I couldn't. I was forbidden from going by the Syrian government. Everybody in my family now is a refugee. Somewhere in over 14 countries, with the exception of my father, my brother, who is stuck in Syria. My mother died. I couldn't go, as I said. My brother is stuck in Syria. And I had the same exact thoughts. He tried, him and his wife, to get a visa to come to the United States or anywhere. He couldn't financially. We cannot help him, and he couldn't help himself to leave. And also nobody will accept him as a refugee or as a tourist, for that matter. And I was thinking exactly the same thing, I think. I may never see him again.
Because of the way things are going.
They were denied a visa to come to the States. Two of his sons managed to escape, and they are refugees in Brazil now. He can't. I have a cousin in Miami whose daughter has a green card, her and her children. They went to Syria now. They canceled their plans to come back for the simple reason. You come to the airport with three or four children and you get stuck in there and you don't know what's going to happen to you. And they have green cards, permanent residency in the United States. So people having a lot of anxiety, a lot of apprehensions and fear. Some people have some fear. I don't have any of this. Right now, I feel the Muslim community should stand with everybody who is extending a helping hand. We have a lawyer with us here today who was expressing her feelings outside. What can I do myself? We have a lot of good people, and we have a system that has the ability to correct itself as long as we stand solid, united, and when the president or the government is wrong, to stand up and tell them, you are wrong and we're going to correct this. And when they are right, we'll help them. We, as a Muslim community, we want to help this country. It is our country by choice. We came here willingly. I wasn't born here to say, I'm stuck, I cannot go anywhere. I willingly did everything in my power. I borrowed money to buy my ticket to come to the United States. And I tell you what, if they're going to send me back, it has to be in a coffin. I will not buy an airplane ticket and be on a seat. But we are here to stay, and we are here to be with everybody who loves freedom, justice, equality, not to preserve it in this country, also to give it to everybody in the world that needs it. And who needs it now more than the millions of those countries who are war-torn countries where the people are in desperate need?
That was an excerpt from a Gulf Coast Live show that originally aired the week after Trump signed his first so-called travel ban. We're taking this hour to listen to some of the award-winning work that WGCU was recently recognized for by the Associated Press and the Radio Television Digital News Directors Association, which awards the Edward R. Murrow Prizes in journalism. Investigative journalism is what many young media professionals aspire to do well. And here at WGCU, our Jessica Mazaros spent several months accumulating documents and evidence for a story about how arsenic levels were reported on land on Pine Island. For this investigation, Jessica was awarded the top prize for investigative reporting from both the Associated Press and the RTDNA, resulting in a regional Edward R. Murrow Award. Here is that story, which originally aired in May of last year.
It's a windy day in St. James City, on the southern tip of Pine Island. Bill Diley is breaking up pieces of bread and throwing them into the brackish lake behind his house.
I'm feeding the turtles.
He does this every day. Diley says he's seen a lot of different creatures in and around the water, like blue crabs, sheep's head fish, and alligators. There's also a mixed group of shorebirds across the lake, and Diley says he sometimes sees an eagle.
It's very rural, very agricultural. People tend to do a lot of fishing and a lot of drinking. People are friendly. Everybody minds their own business.
Bill Diley has lived here in Island Acres Estate about a year and a half. He only recently found out dangerously high levels of the chemical arsenic were recorded on land in his neighborhood, dating back to at least 2011. Even higher levels of arsenic were detected on county-owned conservation land a couple miles away at Pine Island Flatwoods Preserve.
What it means, I'm not sure.
Local hydrogeologist Greg Rawl brought this information to light.
when I first saw the levels, my first thought was, well, there's an error here.
But, he says, he later confirmed with county officials there was no error. Rahl is on the Conservation 2020 Committee that oversees the county's purchasing and monitoring of preserved lands. During a committee meeting, he says he was surprised to find the Pine Island Wastewater Treatment Plant sprays its liquid waste onto the preserve and in Bill Diley's neighborhood.
My initial reaction was I was concerned about nutrient levels, elevated levels of nitrogen and phosphorus.
He says he was worried these nutrients were flowing into the two estuaries that surround Pine Island. Rahl did find nutrients, but he also found arsenic. A state permit requires the county to test the groundwater through monitoring wells to make sure the spraying is not negatively affecting the land. So Rahl pulled up past reports Lee Utilities sent to the Florida Department of Environmental Protection from a DEP database. WGCU also acquired documents the DEP said it did not have, but the county had copies with a DEP date stamp on them.
So when I started looking at the data, I was kind of blown away to find really high arsenic levels.
The documents WGCU obtained show the highest level of arsenic reported by Lee County to the state was in 2013, at 14,000 times higher than the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency allows in drinking water, and nearly 3,000 times higher than EPA standards for surface water bodies. Dr. Ronald Gotz is a private toxicologist in Martin County. He says these elevated levels of arsenic could harm people if they drank the arsenic-laden groundwater or handled contaminated soil.
That's not an amount that you would like to have in your drinking water, because if you drank a liter a day of that, that can make you sick.
Lee County declined to do a recorded interview for this story. But a county spokesperson said in an email that Pine Island residents do not use groundwater wells for drinking. Even so, Dr. Gott says the soil in Bill Diley's neighborhood should at least be tested. Hydrogeologist Greg Rahl says there are a lot of unanswered questions about how this arsenic got onto the land. But he says the first thing that comes to his mind is
illegal dumping. We have absolutely no proof of that. But, you know, to get these high levels, chances are would have to be some kind of waste product from some industrial use.
Public documents show the county hired outside consultant Daniel Aquaviva sometime in 2014 to recommend what to do about the arsenic problem. His report blamed cattle grazing operations for the spikes in arsenic. Rahl says there are a few things wrong with this theory. One, he says cattle do not generate arsenic. Cattle dipping sites do. They're essentially holes in the ground filled with arsenic to dip the cattle and remove ticks. But the DEP's website reports the only cattle dipping site somewhere on Pine Island was in 1933. Two, cattle have been grazing on Pine Island Flatwoods Preserve since the early 2000s, so Rahl questions why arsenic levels would spike up all of a sudden in 2011. And three, Rahl says cattle grazing on the preserve does not explain why high levels of arsenic would also be detected at the Island Acres Estate neighborhood, 2 miles away. Conservation 2020 manager Kathy Olson backed up Rahl's skepticism of cattle causing the high arsenic at a public committee meeting in March.
We don't really know where it came from. We just don't know.
And Rahl says there's something else wrong with consultant Daniel Aquaviva's report. He says his calculations are not right.
And the consultant used the numbers that I pulled offline with the one interesting exception that didn't correspond to what the county had been submitting to the DEP for years.
Rahl says the numbers Aquaviva used would have been right if he multiplied them by 1,000. Aquaviva did not return WGCU's calls for comment. His final report recommends the wells be closed. Then, based on his report, the DEP allowed Lee County to close those wells and open up new ones in 2015. Also, the DEP removed arsenic from the list of things to test for in the new wells. The DEP declined to do a recorded interview, but in an email, a spokesperson says the agency closed the wells and stopped testing for arsenic because it determined the chemical was not coming from the reuse spray water at the Pine Island Wastewater Treatment Plant. The spokesperson would not answer a question regarding whether the DEP was concerned about the environment or nearby estuaries. But now, after hydrogeologist Greg Rall presented his concerns, the Conservation 2020 Committee hired a company to open up three new wells near the previous ones on the Pine Island Flatwoods Preserve and started testing again for arsenic in February.
From a 2020 perspective, we've done what we're supposed to do, I think. And ethically, I've informed the folks that appointed me to this position of the problems. So I've done what I can do.
The first and latest report shows arsenic is present at only three times higher than federal drinking water standards, a significant difference from being thousands of times over in the recent past. So the committee decided not to attempt arsenic removal, since they say it poses no threat to the environment or people at this time. But the Florida Department of Health's website says arsenic deposited on the ground from industrial or agricultural uses tends to stay in the top few feet of soil for a long time. So that brings up a whole other question for Rall. Where did the arsenic go?
That kind of a rapid decrease would indicate that these really high levels of arsenic flushed out into the tidal waters very quickly. And based upon my knowledge of the area, groundwater doesn't move that quickly.
He says another possibility is something was done differently in the testing of these new wells than what was done in the past. The Conservation 2020 Committee has a contract with the company Benchmark to test quarterly for the next 2 years at a total cost of more than $30,000. Back on Pine Island, near Bill Diley's lake, he says he wants to stay on top of the results going forward.
I think the government has this, you know, duty to make people aware of things. People, by and large, that live out here are very ecologically oriented. You know, there's a lot of industry that depends on that, such as fishing, and people are very aware of the quality of the water, mostly water in the Pine Island Sound and its estuaries, and the microcosm it has for, you know, birth and rebirth of the marine species that live there.
Jessica Mazaros, WGCU News, Pine Island.
That was Jessica Mazaros' award-winning investigative piece on arsenic reporting on Pine Island. We're taking this hour to showcase the stories that WGCU did in 2017, which won several awards. Jessica also took home first place trophies for this next piece. This lighter piece on experiencing a dark sky park won a regional Edward R. Murrow Award for Excellence in Writing and an Associated Press trophy for longer format light news.
The night sky at Big Cypress National Preserve looks like this.
It's just a black velvet with diamonds popping up all over the place, almost like glitter. It's absolutely amazing and breathtaking.
The Milky Way is like a smudge in the sky. And then there you could see Orion's Belt, three stars in a row. That's the easiest one to see. And it's like a dream.
Mike Icona of Boca Raton and Abby Gleischer of Boynton Beach say they don't get these views at home.
Mostly we see clouds and we see the sunrise and sunsets, but not all the stars that we see here.
There's no comparison. This is absolutely mind-boggling how many stars are out here.
Skygazers from across the state come to night events like this one at Big Cypress. You cannot really see any of the more than 100 people here, except for some of their artificial lights from cell phones and flashlights bobbing in the distance. But you can hear everyone. There's a long line behind Mary Ann Wallace's telescope. She and a handful of other local amateur astronomers bring their gear to share close-ups of the night sky with everyone.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Okay. Now, if you need to focus, there's a tiny focuser right over here that you can put your hands on.
Wallace from Naples is showing Nick Torres from Tampa Orion's Nebula.
So I see maybe four bright dots, one of them a little hazy.
Yes.
So the hazy one, that's the nebula, right?
That's just a part of the whole nebula.
Very awesome.
Have you ever seen that before?
No, this is the first time I've actually looked in a telescope before. It is absolutely amazing and humbling at the same time. Drove all the way down here just for this because I really wanted to look at some stars. I got exactly what I asked for.
But the black sky, dotted with bright stars of different sizes, is not just for humans to look at. It has a biological purpose as well.
So we're going now to check out some fireflies?
Yeah, exactly.
Luke Gommerman was a park ranger at the preserve and part of the team that worked on getting the International Dark Sky designation. He's now with the National Park Service in Utah. Gommerman takes me on a night walk through Big Cypress to spot the mating habits of fireflies. Males flutter low over the grass, flickering their yellow-green lights from above, as the females flash their lights from the ground.
The male will flash, and then the female will flash the same pattern, that same color and that same number of times. And essentially that's how they find one another in the darkness. And in fact, I just saw one flash over to the right. Oh, there's one. Yeah, it's kind of a yellowish-green color.
Oh, yeah,
and
I see
it. Just flashing once. There it goes again.
And I saw one over there, too.
Yep.
Gommerman says getting rid of some lights throughout the preserve and changing the ones they kept helps the nocturnal wildlife here, like the fireflies.
Now, when we throw our artificial lights in the mix, imagine how confusing that is for a firefly. You know, you're waiting for, say, the darkness to come for you to put on your flashing pattern to find a mate. And all of a sudden, the lights are bright, you think it's day, and even throughout the entire course of the night, it might never be dark enough for you to come out and to look for your own mate.
To the east of Big Cypress, there's a brownish-yellow haze called sky glow. That's Miami. Artificial outdoor lights in that area cause light pollution. And to the northwest is a smaller-scale sky glow coming from Fort Myers and Cape Coral. That's why Diana Umpiere of Pembroke Pines advocates for dark sky friendliness. She's president of the International Dark Sky Association that awards the designation around the world.
One of my hopes I would have is for us to see night sky conservation kind of in the same way that we see issues such as water pollution, air pollution, and some other issues that we care about deeply, to really increase the awareness enough so that our fight to protect the night sky and also just the quality of life at night will really be a mission of not just our organization, but just about every environmental organization out there.
Central Florida's Kissimmee Prairie Preserve State Park was designated a dark sky place last year. Dry Tortugas National Park near Key West is applying for the designation, and Umpiere says St. George Island State Park in the Panhandle plans to as well. She also says Collier and Broward counties are taking steps to be mindful of the night sky. But for now, during the winter months, people can enjoy vivid night skies at Big Cypress, like Pat Omaro and his daughter Kelsey Omaro of Coral Springs. They first connected over the night sky after Hurricane Wilma in 2005.
All the trees had been knocked down in our neighborhood and all the lights were out. And I remember he took me out and just started pointing out constellations and showed me the Milky Way for the first time.
There was no light haze like from Miami. Everything was dark. And then it was followed by a cold front that it was gorgeous.
So the father and daughter came to Big Cypress to see the dark sky together again.
Well, my eyes, they can't see as well. She can see things in the light pollution of Metropolitan, but I can't. So I wanted to really see.
What is it? What is it like for you?
It's great. I love it. Yeah.
Jessica Mazaros, WGCU News.
WGCU also took home a regional Edward R. Murrow for its continuing coverage of a story that first came to light in the middle of 2017, thanks to an investigation by the Fort Myers News Press. The story of toxic sludge dumping in the Dunbar neighborhood was reported by Quincy Walters, whose work earned a regional Edward R. Murrow Award for continuing coverage and was a finalist in the same category for the Florida Associated Press. Here are those stories from back when the toxic sludge's existence was revealed through the city's decision to hire attorneys to handle the situation.
Welcome to the South Street Environmental Assessment Public Information Workshop. There's a lot of information to go over, so let's get started.
Attending the workshop was a lot like going to an amusement park. People were put in a holding room where a narrator with a booming voice gave some history.
In 1962, over 50 years ago, the city agreed to purchase the South Street property to be used for lime sludge disposal.
The presentation gave a mutually agreed definition of lime sludge by the city of Fort Myers and by the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. They define it as a byproduct of the lime softening water treatment process. Lime is added to water to reduce hardness and reduce chemicals like calcium, magnesium, and arsenic.
Lime sludge from water treatment plants is often applied on farm fields where the soil pH is too low, thereby enhancing plant growth.
However, the city purchased that vacant lot on South Street in Dunbar and opted to dump the sludge there. Different generations of kids played on that lot purchased by the city to hold 25,000 cubic yards of lime sludge. People have wells that could have been affected by the water that ran off from the lot. The concern is that people ingested and touched whatever chemical byproduct was there. Now the city wants to find out exactly what was in that byproduct. At the workshop this week, there was another room with a sort of information petting zoo about the dumping. There were tables with maps of where the dumping happened, tables with documents related to the site from the Florida DEP, and tables with tools used to test the water and soil at the dump site. Residents were given comment forms to submit. Teresa Hamilton filled one out. She says she lives right across the street from the dump site.
My grandbaby used to play over there, and she came down sick, and now she uses a breathing machine. And I have to keep other kids from playing over there because from all the years I've been raised in that area, they always told me it was a sinkhole. When it rains over there, it's a loud odor, a loud smell from over there when it rains over there.
She says the city had decades to stop dumping, but it didn't, and she has a theory about that.
It's the black neighborhood. They don't care nothing about the black neighborhood.
Fellow Dunbar resident Willie Chatters, who's lived there since the 60s, wouldn't necessarily say that's the reason why. He thinks it has to do with population volume rather than demographic.
I guess a lot of people wasn't living there at the time, you know, and then people started to build up, you know. But even if when people started to build up, maybe they should have told somebody about it, you know, because you know, I'm pretty sure a lot of people wouldn't have built there, you know, if there was a problem, you know, but.
Dumping started in the 60s, and there's no record of when the city stopped. However, in 1993, the city built a new water treatment plant, which no longer produced lime sludge. Geologist Scott McManus was at the workshop to explain the equipment that'll be used to test the dump site.
What we have here is a OVA, or PID meter. This is used to sniff soil. It takes readings of volatile organics that are in the soil.
McManus says a geologist's role is to test the water and soil and to determine what the environmental impacts have been. Gary Meyer with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection says lime sludge is not considered a significant risk to humans.
The assessment that's being conducted now will provide very good scientific information, and part of the assessment that's in progress is to determine exactly what risks there were, both historical and going forward.
In addition to the geological tests, the city is also seeking permission to test the wells of people who live within a quarter mile of where the lime sludge was dumped. Citizens have until August 15th to submit comments. Testing won't begin until after those comments are reviewed. But Teresa Hamilton, the Dunbar resident who says she lives across the street from the dumping site, says whatever the results may be, it's too little, too late. Quincy Walters, WGCU News. Right now, I'm on a plot of land in Dunbar, and the weeds here are taller than I am. And it's where the Florida Department of Environmental Protection is using ground-penetrating radar, or GPR, to find out exactly what lies beneath the soil. The DEP's South Regulatory District Director, John Eigelhart, is here at the property on South Street. He says the plot of land was a borrow pit, essentially a big sandbox used to store materials like soil and gravel and the city's sludge waste. Now they're trying to figure out how much of the land may need to be cleaned up.
We did some sampling, and we think we know where the edges are, pretty much from aerials from the 50s, 60s. And so this will allow us really to hone in on where the boundaries are, where the fill is, how deep it is, and if there's anything in there besides lime sludge.
The city of Fort Myers and the Department of Environmental Protection define lime sludge as a byproduct of the lime softening water treatment process. Lime is added to water to reduce hardness and reduce chemicals like calcium, magnesium, and arsenic. The sludge is a semi-solid made up mostly of calcium carbonate. And the city dumped that lime sludge on this lot between the 50s and 90s. The concern is that people ingested and touched whatever chemical byproduct was here. Now the city wants to find out exactly what was in that byproduct and if any other substances accumulated. Before DEP geologists can use their ground-penetrating radar, which looks a lot like a lawnmower, they have to cut tall grass with a machete and move dumped car parts out of the way. DEP geologist Clint Cromhout is using the GPR to kind of see beneath the earth.
What this piece of equipment will be able to do is potentially show you where the area has been disturbed from excavation versus the natural soil levels that have been undisturbed. It could potentially indicate where maybe additional testing is going to be done. It's going to tell you absolutely nothing about the content and the makeup of the soil.
The GPR sends a radio signal down into the earth and measures the amount of time it takes for that signal to reflect off an object or layer and return to the receiver. Ricky Rogers stands across the street observing the testing. He lives down the block.
Yes, I was born and raised over here. So I knew about it, but we didn't know what it was. We played in it.
The DEP's John Eigelhart says what happened here could change the way the department operates.
As we're looking back at how things played out here, this is kind of larger than Fort Myers at this point. It's how the department looks at these sites throughout the state of Florida.
Meaning it might be time to revisit the rules about notifying people of dumping near their homes. Eigelhart says the results of this day's tests will be available in 2 weeks. Quincy Walters, WGCU News, Dunbar. In a November report, groundwater tests from around Dunbar's toxic sludge dump site show the presence of arsenic. One reading found up to 53 micrograms of arsenic in one monitoring well. That's more than 5 times higher than the Environmental Protection Agency's safe standard of 10 micrograms. 2 other results were beyond that safe standard as well. The city hired a company to test the wells again this week. 2 members of Florida's Department of Environmental Protection are also at the site standing by. Jeannie Scott lives across the street from where the city dumped lime sludge, a byproduct of the water treatment process from the 60s until the 90s. She says she just found out the area was potentially toxic back in June when the city put a fence up around the site.
All my kids kind of raised up playing in there, and recently the grandkids was over there just before they put the gate around it.
Scott says she also recently found out the property she lives on was once home to a dump site.
I'm getting someone to come out and start testing my water.
Earlier this year, the city of Fort Myers offered to test wells of residents who live nearby, but Scott says she didn't trust them. At a city council meeting this week, residents of Dunbar share their stories of illnesses from multiple sclerosis to cancer. They urge the city to react quicker.
My wife was brought up on Jeffcott Street. Mm-hmm. She's 55 years old. She can't walk anymore. She got MS. Played in that same stuff that we played in. I've been going back to the doctor for years now, and they can't find out the problem with my stomach.
Multiple myeloma. That's the cancer that I was diagnosed with. So my plea to you guys tonight is don't overlook us. It's something out there that's making us sick.
That was Ricky Rogers and LaShonda Evans-Williams talking to city council members. Evans-Williams, who has multiple myeloma, a blood cancer, says she was diagnosed in 2013 when she was given 3 to 7 years to live. She's in the 4th year of that diagnosis.
I'm not able to work. I've had a bone marrow transplant. I go through chemo radiation. I take stuff for my bones.
Evans-Williams says she was hesitant to speak at this week's city council meeting, but she feels that the Dunbar community has been ignored for decades, and she feels she doesn't have long to live.
If that time shall come, I want my voice to be heard before I leave this earth. I want people to know to get out, get tested, get screening, get anything you need on your health. Because if you don't look out for yourself, no one else is going to look out for you.
At that same city council meeting, in a 5-to-1 vote, the city council votes to spend up to $150,000 to get legal counsel to defend against potential lawsuits from residents. Anthony Thomas, who used to live in Dunbar, says there's a better way to spend that money.
The city apparently feels that it is more appropriate to spend this money to defend themselves against their citizens who have been affected by this than to spend any money on those citizens to set up free cancer screenings and set up screenings for exposure to arsenic. You know, this is outrageous.
Councilman Johnny Streets, who represents Dunbar, voted to get the city legal counsel, but there's a condition to his vote.
And with the fact that this is not against
no.
our constituents.
Right.
Or our citizens.
Councilwoman Terrellyn Watson is the only opposing vote in getting legal counsel. She says the optics are going to look bad to Dunbar residents.
Regardless of how we sit up here and say it, it still makes them feel like we're fighting against them. We could say we're not all day long, but they're going to believe something else different because we're hiring an attorney.
Instead, Watson asks, why can't the money for lawyers be used to give medical screenings to people in Dunbar? The city manager, Saeed Kazimi, tells her they need to wait until the test results come in to know what they're dealing with. The results from this week's test should be available in January, and the city has already retained legal counsel. Quincy Walters, WGCU News, Fort Myers.
We're taking this hour to look back at the stories which won numerous awards in 2017, many of which were just announced last week. Next, we have the story of improving graduation rates at Immokalee High School, which was a finalist this year for the Florida Associated Press in the category of Feature, Cultural and Historical Reporting. Rachel Iacovone put together this award-winning piece.
Jennifer Guerrero Torres comes from a family of immigrants. Her mother is from Honduras, and her absent father is from El Salvador. When her parents split up, she was brought, as an infant, to Immokalee. Its name means my home in the Miccosukee Indian language, and for Guerrero Torres, it's the only one she's ever known. That will change when she moves to Massachusetts later this summer to attend Harvard.
For most of my life, I lived in Immokalee, and I'd actually never left the state of Florida until I went to visit the university in person.
Immokalee is home to more than 20,000 full-time residents, though its population nearly doubles during harvest season. Guerrero Torres' mother is one of the many farm workers, while her stepfather has worked in construction for as long as she can remember.
They never received a formal education in the countries that they're from. My mother only received a sixth grade education, and my stepfather only went up to second grade.
Her parents are not alone. The American Community Survey from the U.S. Census revealed 60% of adults in Immokalee had less than a high school education in 2015. Guerrero Torres, though, is part of a turnaround. After duly enrolling at Florida Gulf Coast University her final 2 years, she earned enough credits to get her associate's degree and boost her grade point average to a 5.5. She was Immokalee High's valedictorian and the school's first student to be accepted to Harvard as an undergrad.
The people that really pushed me to achieve more, to always try my best in school, were really my teachers. They're amazing.
In the last decade, Immokalee High School has seen a rise from a 60% graduation rate in 2007 to 91% in 2016. Collier County Public Schools began calculating high school graduation rates to match the federal formula in 2012. They no longer counted special and GED-based diplomas, or students who transferred, died, or dropped out in the rate. Immokalee High's rate of standard diploma graduates has risen by more than 10% in the last 4 years. Both county and school administration officials say it has less to do with the calculation change and more to do with the hiring of Superintendent Kamala Patton. The Executive Director of Secondary Programs, Leslie Riccadelli, says Patton made lower-performing students her main focus since her first day in 2011 through the use of data dialogues. These deep dives into each school's data intend to help administrators understand the areas needing improvement and distribute resources accordingly.
And it's obviously proven to work because the number of state assessments that we meet or exceed the state in performance and the graduation rate all have skyrocketed since she's been here.
Jesus Galan dropped out of Immokalee High School after dealing with the death of his first child. Back when he attended, less than two-thirds of its students were crossing that stage at the end.
A lot of the teachers look at the star students instead of looking at the lowest student. And instead of helping the lowest student, end up helping more of the star student.
Galan, now a father of three, says it's on parents, even more so than teachers, to keep students in school. His father, a farm worker for more than 40 years, used his experience to keep Galan's siblings in line.
When they didn't want to go to school, my dad would take them to the field and said, this is going to be the end result if you don't finish your school. And they didn't like the field, so they went back to school.
Galan is now a student at Immokalee Technical College, or iTech, It's right across the street from Immokalee High School, in the town's sole post-secondary option. Full disclosure, my mother is a workforce education advisor there. It offers dual enrollment to high school students, which iTech student 23-year-old Isaiah Rosales says he wishes was around earlier.
Sometimes these kids learn differently than what the teacher might teach, like, and it frustrates the kid and the kid just gives up. But sometimes I think when they see a kid not being receptive to what they're trying to teach them, it's easy to just be like, okay, well, they've given up, I'm going to give up.
Rosales admits he started to get lazy around sophomore year, and by junior year, he began hanging out with the wrong crowd.
They were basically focused on partying and just things like that, you know, things that did not matter.
Rosales says associating with those kinds of students is what kept him from attending a big state school after graduation. He did attend Florida Southwestern State College, though, before he had to drop out to help support his parents and little sister. It was while working multiple part-time jobs that he realized his true passion for helping others, so he enrolled in iTech's licensed practical nursing program. Audrey Moss has been at Immokalee High for 34 years. First as a teacher, and then as the head of the guidance department. She says the administration has worked to keep students, like Rosales and Galan, from feeling neglected in recent years.
We have watch lists, and we monitor the students so that we don't let those that are that level of kid fall through the cracks. And there are more opportunities for the students to do different things, such as the early admissions that Jennifer did.
Immokalee High School's 2017 graduation rate has yet to be reported, but Moss says she anticipates it to be, once again, in the 90% range for the third consecutive year. Rachel Iacovone, WGCU News, Immokalee.
That was Rachel Iacovone's award-winning piece called about the graduation rates improving at Immokalee High School. That won the Florida Associated Press Award in the feature cultural and historical reporting. Rachel also won the top prize in sports reporting in 2017. That award came from the Associated Press as well. The story is about the pickleball craze and a major investment in it by the Bonita Springs YMCA. We're about out of time for this hour, but you can hear that story online at gulfcoastlive.org. We've spent this hour looking back at 2017 and hearing the award-winning stories that WGCU reported throughout the year. It's because of the quality work by everyone here at our station that we were also recognized as the Florida Associated Press Radio Station of the Year. We plan to continue that positive growth and that award-winning streak into the years to come, and that's why we've added hourly newscasts so you can hear what's important to you here in Southwest Florida every hour throughout the day. We also added the Southwest Florida angle on the state legislative session with John Davis's Legislative Roundtable. That series gives us a local perspective as to what's happening in Tallahassee. We've also brought back the Thursday Arts Edition, in which John Davis highlights the very important arts scene in our area. And we have the legendary Mike Canary back here at WGCU, who now hosts his podcast, Three Song Stories, which you can find online and on our app. And I've joined forces with Gina Birch for another podcast called Grape Minds. It's all about the culture, history, science, and business behind wine, also available on our app and online. We keep improving, and that is thanks to you, our listeners. That's all the time we have for our show today. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary, yours truly, and Rachel Iacovone. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida.